Hello, I'm Scott Soschnick.
And I'm Eben Novy Williams, and this is the Damn It Feels Good to Be a Scherzer sports business podcast, The Sportacast.
All right, not bad. Yeah. And we have to emphasize, at time of recording, you know, all we know is that Max Scherzer is being courted by the New York Mets, right?
People are saying deal done now in the past.
Oh, people saying deal done.
20 minutes or so, yeah.
So, all right. So what we kind of know, what's out there is that 40 plus million. So we're going to, end up somewhere around there. Steve Cohen opening the pocketbook for Max Scherzer and DeGrom and Scherzer, right? Number 1-2 tandem. That's pretty darn good.
Not too
bad.
Nobody
gets hurt. Yeah, that's pretty good. I guess Stevie wants to win, right?
Yeah, I think if you were a Mets fan who was thrilled about Steve Cohen taking over, this is exactly the kind of thing you were excited about. I won't say this deal would never have happened under the Wilpon regime, but this is the kind of thing that I think Mets fans really wanted to happen and were frustrating wasn't happening enough. A really big, splashy, grade A, top tier signing. And Scott, 3 years, $130 million, $43.3 million average annual value on this contract, by far the most expensive single year average annual value deal in Major League Baseball history.
Now, I know Max Scherzer's really good, and he's been one of the best for the last, 5-10 years, whatever it's been. I guess if you're Steve Cohen, the money doesn't really matter. You can spend what you want. He wants to win. That's clearly what we've seen here. He wants to win, and that comes after criticizing an agent of another player he was going after. This wasn't handled the proper way. And if you're Scherzer, you think maybe was Cohen a stalking horse, but no, like he's if it's true, he's coming to New York. And boy, again, pairing him with Jacob DeGrom, you put Fannies in the seats, best 1-2 combo in all of baseball. But what I find interesting, Eben, is not even, we get who, what, when, where, why when you want to tell a full story. This one is not the what or even the how much. It's the when. I find this to be the most interesting part of this because the criticism from the players' union aimed at some baseball teams is that they're not spending money. Here's one deep pocket, big market, big revenue team that did, and it's not the only one. As we approach the deadline or the expiration of a labor contract, that I think this is fair to say will wind up in some sort of work stoppage. I don't know if we'll lose games, but we'll wind up in some sort of lockout and work stoppage.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Scott. I wrote down some of the deals we've seen in the past 24, 48 hours here. Kevin Gausman signed a $110 million deal. Byron Buxton, a $100 million deal. Wander Franco, a $180 million deal. It does certainly seem as though right now we're 2 days out from what everyone assumes is going to be that lockout. Baseball teams seem to kind of be doing in this little window the thing that players have been accusing them of not doing for so long. I think there's a few logical explanations to that. One, if this lockout does happen, all of free agency gets put on pause. I can certainly understand teams wanting to have a better idea of what the roster looks like now, as opposed to having to wait until this deal gets done. And that could be February, March, April, May. It could even be later than that. There's more interest for teams, I think, now to get these deals done before the lockout, because you can't do any deals during the lockout. Two other things here that I wrote down. One, Mike McCann wrote for it on Sportico. Really interesting. Depending on when this Biden Build Back Better, when the new tax plan kicks in, there could be some tax implications for players who have to pay more on their signing bonus if they do that deal next year, depending on when that deal gets signed versus when they do it now. So there may be some implications there. And then lastly, what's going on, right now on the labor talks. Again, this is the kind of deal that Major League Baseball players are saying is happening less and less, particularly at the end of their career. Max Scherzer is 37 years old. So much of the conversation around Major League Baseball's changing salaries has highlighted the fact that when players reach the end of their careers, they're not getting the big ticket deals that they used to get 5 or 10 years ago. Well, Max Scherzer is at the end of his career, and this is a 3-year deal that's more expensive than any deal in baseball history.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, one of the top issues we've seen is that the union says that younger players need to get paid. As the analytics become more important, you're uncovering younger players who deliver more value, and they want to find a way for those younger players to get paid. But then if you want the security, you got to give up a little something, right? So I think that's what we're seeing with some of these deals, like, you know, Byron Buxton, you mentioned him. And while $100 million over 7 years is a lot of money, I would think a player of that caliber in his prime, age 27, and a free agent would get a lot more money. But it's not just the big market, big revenue teams like the Mets we're seeing. You know, you have the Marlins locking up some players, the Twins and Buxton, who, by the way, and I would say if top five favorite players of one focus group of one, Jackson Soshnick.
There you go.
Because of MLB Speed. The Show, he loves Byron Buxton. Like he calls him Daddy Buxton. I don't know if this is a thing like the kids call like the players they like the best Daddy. So every time like he's screaming around the house, Daddy Buxton did it again. So, you know, just on that alone, the fact that he's so popular with the young kids, I will tell you, pay the man, he knows. But again, the Twins, the Marlins, you mentioned Wander Franco, that's the Rays. Like, you know, these are not high revenue teams. And if the Rays thinks it's a darn good idea to give Wander Franco that kind of money, can you imagine what he'd be worth in 4 or 5 years if you project what his production would be like?
Part of me does wonder if come next week as lawyers for the union and the league sit down to talk about some of these things, if the league doesn't say, what do you mean we're not spending? Look, just a week ago, the Rays spent $180 million on a young prospect, and the Twins gave $100 million to Daddy Buxton. I do wonder if this will come up pretty quickly. Scott, we're recording this on Monday at midnight on Wednesday. The current labor agreement ends. If there's not a deal, and it certainly seems like there's not going to be.
I will go on record. There will be
There will be no deal. Lockout likely starts on Thursday. We've been pretty clear on that on this show. Anything in the past week or so changed your mind on what you're thinking in terms of how big a deal this may be and how long it could take for an agreement to be reached?
No, nothing has changed my mind.
Yeah, I agree there.
I have covered so many of these labor stoppages in all sports, but particularly focused in years past on the NBA. And, David Stern approached negotiations this way. He didn't look to get everything in one fell swoop. If he wanted a salary cap or a luxury tax, or what he would do is he would just get the concept inserted into the agreement, even if in dollars and cents changing hands, it didn't mean a whole lot. But you had to get the concept, or at least the mechanics of what you wanted, inserted into a deal. And then down the line, the next negotiation, you tighten that screw. And then the next one, you tighten that screw. And you wonder, is there an event? Has there been any big event that would force owners or players to coalesce and galvanize? You're going to hear that word galvanize, you know, a lot during negotiations. And in the NBA years ago, it was the Kevin Garnett contract. You know, where I think he eclipsed like $30 million for a single season. And the owners went bonkers. They were like, no way, we've got to do something. And the union wound up agreeing to a pay limit on the high-end people. Like they understood, and like Kobe Bryant, of course, understood that he wasn't going to get paid what his fair value was. And they were going to sacrifice those few high-end players so that the money could trickle down. And at the time, I don't remember who it was, but I do clearly remember somebody saying that the owners are going to regret this. And here was the reason why. Because now that you've installed a maximum salary between ego and need of individual franchises, rather than spread it out to everybody, say, well, what's going to happen? And this is what did wind up happening, is that every best player or every fan favorite, whatever it might be on each individual team, is going to say, pay me the max. I want a max deal. And that played out. Yes, it pulled more people up than it limited. So, and the distribution of dollars then would become a problem, because every single, like, pick a team, doesn't even have to be a playoff team, but the best player, the most popular player on any particular team, when that guy became a free agent, he and the agent said, I want the max. It was just an easy thing to say. I'm the best player here. You want to build around me, whatever, then you got to pay me the max. So be careful what you wish for, because sometimes you actually get it.
So those are the clouds that are looming over baseball, but at least right now and for the next 24 hours, it's a darn good time. It seems to be an elite baseball player. It also, Scott, is a darn good time to be an elite college football coach. We have seen in the past few weeks a near record number of top tier college football coach openings happening, and a lot of big ticket deals. The most recent, Lincoln Riley, the young coach at Oklahoma, moving over to USC. We don't have the numbers on that deal yet, but I assume he's going to be one of the highest paid coaches in college football. Mel Tucker at Michigan State, James Franklin at Penn State, both signed 10-year deals north of $80 and $90 million, respectively. It seems as though we are entering, Scott, this new tier of deal and salary for elite college football coaches.
The question I have for you, because there's also that database that we have, that we look at all of the dead money being paid to coaches. And I do chuckle every time when you look at like the highest paid state employee, that map across America, almost every state, it's a basketball coach or a football coach. So you throw the dead money on top of that. You throw in the purpose of the universities. Where's the money coming from, Eben? Is this one of those almost like a bond where you say, well, revenue from the games and concessions? Or are universities starting to look outside to boosters to get that guy who can deliver? I don't know that, you know me, I don't follow the college football too closely. Of course, I know these coaches' names, but I did see already a top recruit for Oklahoma said Lincoln Riley going to USC changes everything. Like, now you're going to see if this person's going to go and play for USC.
Yeah, it's a number. It's more than one recruit leaving Oklahoma, decommitting. The quarterback at the start of the year, Spencer Rattler, he said he's going to enter the transfer portal. They lost to Oklahoma State this past weekend. It's been a rough 48 hours for Oklahoma. But to answer your question, Scott, I think it's both. I think there were certainly a large contingent of Michigan State boosters who paid up to help keep Mel Tucker around. He had a great start to the year, and then things kind of went sour. But also, yeah, schools are looking at future revenue streams. There's a few conferences that have big new media deals that are going to kick in soon, SEC included, that certainly make them feel pretty confident, I think, about the future. And then kind of more broadly, there's more of a sense than there ever has been in college football right now that we are schisming the haves and the have-nots. And I say that knowing full well that there is not a ton of parity right now in college football, but a lot of people in powerful positions around the sport feel very strongly that that gap is going to widen even more considerably in the next 5 years. And that happens as Oklahoma and Texas go to the SEC, as the NCAA gives more deferential treatment and more oversight and more punishment and more rulemaking jurisdiction to individual conferences, which everyone says is going to create even more of this Power Five or elite, you know, super conference than we have right now. Everyone seems to think that it is the now or never time for a lot of programs to kind of solidify their positioning at the top tier of college football, because if you're not at the top tier, you could very easily find yourself in a gap that you cannot bridge back up to that tier.
I love that you know the quarterback's name. Like, I could not have. You give me 1,000 guesses. Like, who's the choir? I have no idea.
He's got a great name, Spencer Rattler.
Yeah, Spencer Rattler. That's great. I mean, wasn't that like a, it wasn't the Rattlers, wasn't that an Arena Football League team name? Like, Rattler to the Rattlers or the something?
I think it was what was the Charlie Eversole one? I think it was that league.
Oh, okay.
The AFL. Wow, this is embarrassing.
Yeah, Tom Dungeon said, I'm going to give you a certain amount, but it wasn't exactly all of it. Right. Yeah,
it was that one. And I
the something of American football, the Association of American football, the something of American football.
Yes, AAF. Yeah, that, you got it. Nice.
Thank you. There we go. And now we've got more coming, by the way. We haven't really ever talked about the USFL coming back and the XFL coming back. Yeah. We know what we should do that in one of these shows. We should talk about spring football and the viability of it and how people plan to make it work. That'd be fun. But you know the quarterback's name. Like, I'd rather discuss somebody like Matt Ishbia, who, you know, will walk on at Michigan State. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, does the athletic director, university president, do they pick up the phone and say, well, Matt, Sparty here needs a little more help. I know you've donated a lot, but we'd like to keep our football coach, and it's going to take, what was it, $80, $90 million to keep him. What do you think about a check directly made to the athletic department to fund just a football coaching position? They should have it, you know, the endowed Matt Ishbia. I mean, I know he's a basketball walk-on, but what the heck? Throw it around the football team too. They need a little love.
Yeah, I don't know exactly who makes the first call in that scenario, but that is exactly the setup that we have on campuses all over, and that's been happening for years. But yeah, what you mentioned, buyouts, it's often that a college will fire a coach And the buyout is being funded by a lot of boosters, many of whom are calling the AD on a weekly basis, telling them they need to get a new coach anyway. So a lot of these decisions, both the decision and the financial part of the decision, ends up being made by boosters that can make, you know, that they are an extremely influential group of people depending on what campus you're on. And yes, the money talks in a lot of ways. I mean, you mentioned the buyout, Scott. Just want to mention this because I think this is so indicative of where college sports and college football is right now. Virginia Tech fired Justin Fuente in the middle of November. His contract had a $10 million buyout. If they had waited until the end of the year, until middle of December, the buyout would have been $7.5 million. But they felt it was so important to open that position up and start looking for new coaches 4 weeks earlier than that they were willing to eat a much bigger buyout to do it. And that, to me, just is a perfect encapsulation of where things are right now.
You want a perfect encapsulation of where things are with us? You mean to tell me Frank Beamer is not the coach at Virginia Tech and Michael Vick is not the quarterback? Is that what you were insinuating right now?
Michael Vick, definitely not the quarterback. Frank Beamer, also definitely not the coach.
Yeah, well, I am about to unload all of my Virginia Tech football knowledge, okay, besides knowing the Hokies.
Besides,
you ready for this?
Two, yeah.
Yeah, and knowing that Frank Beamer and Michael Vick, here it is. This is all of it.
Okay.
Very good back then. Back in the day, very good special teams.
Oh, interesting. And very lunch pail defense, Bud Foster. That was the under Frank Beamer was a big thing. But to this point, exactly. What every school wants is for you to know the coach because he's been there forever and he's had a lot of success, right? Virginia Tech wants to find the next Frank Beamer who can be there for a decade plus, who even people that tangentially follow college football know very well. They know his calling card, if it's special teams, if it's defense, whatever it is. And schools are increasingly looking, one, to find that person, and two, when they think they've found it, like Michigan State seems to do with Mel Tucker, or like Penn State seems to do with James Franklin, they are now willing to pay record amounts. You know, we never saw coaches making $10 million a year until a couple of years ago, and now there's going to be a chunk of them next year, and that's the whole market has shifted upwards.
We better break the story when it happens that, whether it's Bain Capital or Redbird Capital or BlackRock or KKR, when somebody makes a serious move to privatize college football, the top 30, 40 schools, just under the umbrella of a bunch of private equity firms, where it is really about wringing every dollar you can out of the enterprise. What a great story. I look forward to the day when there's four or five private equity firms running the sport of college football and everybody's awash in money. That's where we're headed. Am I wrong?
I agree with that. I would argue that the SEC could very easily, even without the private equity backing, be heading in that direction anyway, right? The idea here would be concentrate some of the biggest brands in college football, have them just playing each other and
forget
about the rest.
Yeah, but then you have to have the appearance of institutions of higher learning. Like, if we can get rid of a pretense of having to fill some sort of academic mandate and privatize this thing, then we got ourselves some college football.
Yes. And yeah, that might be a hard sell and for some presidents and some deans, but for others, it might not. And I think you and I are in agreement that things are just going to move increasingly that way. I mean, the fully privatization might not happen for a while, but again, if the NCAA is going to let the SEC make its own rules, we could very easily be heading towards whatever that privatization, what that looks like in basic practice, just within the SEC rubric.
I look forward to the statement signed by all the members of the Drake Group. And if you're not familiar with what the Drake Group is, I will let you go to the Google Drake Group, and then you'll be in on the conversation. Anyway, but you know, it is fully privatized, Evan. NFL, MLB, NBA, MLS, all the leagues, and our colleague Brendan Coffey with a great story today on the Fitch Ratings Agency, and really just the company. It's not a government agency, but Fitch took a look at sort of the creditworthiness of all the pro sports leagues and coming off one big gut punch of coronavirus. But I mean, is it a surprise? NFL A+, league-wide credit facilities A, NBA debt A-, MLB debt A-. I mean, you're talking about what are the risks of doing business with these entities? And it seems like the business of sport is pretty damn good right now.
There was so much, you know, thought about what the pandemic was going to mean for franchises. Obviously, there was a lot of unknown about what the pandemic was going to mean countrywide and for businesses in all types. It certainly feels as though, you know, knock on wood right now, we are 18 months after the start of the pandemic. business seems to still be very good for the NFL, particularly. I would separate the NFL, I think, from those others, but also a lot of the other U.S. leagues. The ticket sales took a big dip. Media, most of them fulfilled a large amount of their media requirements. The demand on the, certainly on the TV side, seems to be pretty strong right now. Ticketing, yes or no, in some ways, depending on who you ask. But in maybe the most important thing from what Fitch looks at, which is, you know, the your bonds and your ability to pay back your loans, valuations are skyrocketing. It's something that we've written a ton about at Sportico. We've talked a lot about it on this show.
And I think inflation will probably only send them higher.
And that's very possible. So if valuations are going up, I think it only makes sense that your debt rating and your debt capacity or your ability to pay back that debt also goes up.
Yeah, if people are wondering, what does it all mean? I mean, like if your house goes up in value, it's easier to go take out a mortgage or take out a loan because it's worth more. It's the same thing with these pro franchises. And by the way, I mean, I looked at like the total debt. I was surprised at the low numbers, right? NFL, $10 billion in debt, NBA, 7.6, MLB, $5 billion. That's nothing, especially when backed on the guaranteed revenue of the broadcast contracts. And then, of course, I mean, COVID related, I know, but if fans are in the stadiums, you wonder why. It's not a surprise, I should say, why, you know, the agencies are all like, oh, well, all right, I get it. They have enough revenue to pay back all this debt.
And that is both, as you know, Scott, both by design and also higher than normal. I think both the NFL and the NBA, if I'm correct on that, in the past 2 years
has raised
the debt ceiling for teams. Yeah. So, you know, not only is it deliberately kept that low, but it is higher now than it would have been if you'd looked at those numbers 2 or 3 years ago. So, you're absolutely right.
All right, let's take a look, and we'll end with Fenway Sports Group. Looks like they signed their purchase agreement of the Pittsburgh Penguins last night. We were first to the Twitter with that to let the world know, and looks like Ron Burkle and Mario Lemieux will stay on in the ownership group. Mario will run the hockey ops, but I find it interesting, all right, that they're selling but staying in. You get a sense that Burkle understands there's still upside in pro sports. We value the team at like 840, or Kurt Bodenhausen, 840, 145 million bucks, something like that. But Fenway, with the latest move, again, Sam Kennedy, he preached it to anybody who would listen, that they're a platform company. And they are, when you're looking to sell, you get the for sale sign out there. What do you put out when you're looking to buy? Like, are they Zillow sending me emails? We want to buy your house. I know they stopped doing that, right? But that would be the equivalent, right? Fenway is like sending out the emails. Like, we want to buy your team. We want to buy your network. We want to buy your whatever that is associated with sport, because we are growing. They take iconic brands and they see how they can mesh them all together and see how they fit in one happy, profitable bunch.
Yeah. And going back to Burkle and Lemieux for a second, Mario, Hall of Famer, played his entire career in Pittsburgh, obviously as someone who means a lot to Penguins fans. I totally understand the desire to keep him as part of the group. He seems like a valuable kind of ambassador between the team and the players in a way. And then for Burkle, I think is also kind of true similarly as well. The Mario and Ron bought this team out of bankruptcy, I believe, in the 1990s. A lot of people feel as though if they had not done that and stepped up when they did, the team might not even be in Pittsburgh at all anymore. It's obviously worked out well to the tune of 3 Stanley Cups in the past 15 years. But I definitely understand, and I'm sure this is part of the desire from Fenway Sports Group, is that, hey, these guys mean a lot in the local community. They can be really good ambassadors, as we are, not Pittsburgh people at all, here sitting where we are in Boston or New York, wherever a lot of those Fenway executives are. It seems like a logical decision if they wanted to stay in to kind of keep them there as important kind of ambassadors between the two sides.
What do you mean we're not Pittsburgh people? I have myself enjoyed a Primanti Brothers sandwich on more than one occasion. I have also, as a masochist, on more than one occasion, driven the 6+ hours west on both 80 and 78 to see which I preferred. The answer is 80 to Pittsburgh for, Jackson Soshnick to take on the Junior Penguins, or Penguins Elite, I believe is the official name. And the last time we played them, you know, this is what I love about social media.
Are those games in PPG Paints Arena?
No, they are in the Penguins practice facility.
Okay, gotcha.
Which is a wonderful facility. Like, it isn't often where we get to go and you can watch a game in like just a t-shirt or sweatshirt, but total climate control. The ice is perfect.
That's
nice. You know, more than one rink. Yeah, really, really nice. Anytime you play in the NHL practice facilities, you know, you're in for a treat, or the real games, you know, that's nice too. But every time, this is like kind of goes with social media. You see parents posting things on their kids. And if it's a, if you see a kid like at plate playing baseball, you know, it's going to be a big hit. If you see him like running a route, you know, they're going to score a touchdown or something really, really good. Well, I'm not ashamed to tell you our last trip in Pittsburgh, and the Pens elite are darn good. You know, we're a good team too, but they were darn good. We beat them in the first game. Just so happened we had a rematch, I believe, in the semifinals or finals, maybe, whatever it was. I think the final score was 7-3. I mean, I can go look it up on my phone. Neither, but they outshot us 43-18. Like, we took a couple of stupid penalties, and they, I'm telling you, if you get a chance to go watch the 2009 Pens Elite, go watch their power play, because there's some NHL teams who can learn a thing or two from these boys. They run a wicked power play, and they kicked our butts solid. But hey, there you go. Not always the perfect ending for your kid's sports team. I'm not ashamed. I share all of that, the good, the bad, the ugly, and that was one ugly day. Speaking of ugly, he is Eben Novy Williams on the Twitter at Novy_Williams. I am Scott Soschnick on Twitter at Soschnick. Our social media editor is Cora Veltman. She loves when I remind you that the show can be found at Sporticast, which is the hub of what will soon become the hub of the Sportico Podcast Network.